From Public Radio International, I'm Hari Srinivasan, and this is America Abroad. In the last couple of years in Africa, terrorists have been particularly ruthless in their tactics, from bombing a crowded mall in Kenya, to kidnapping schoolgirls in Nigeria, to this in Somalia.
Al-Shabaab attacked the city at night, and they buried the main borehole that supplied water to the city.
Terrorists in Somalia have resorted to using water as a tool of war. They destroy water wells to demonstrate their power so that the Somali people and their animals cannot drink. In a desert climate, these tactics are lethal and effective. In Turkana, Kenya, boys bring AK-47s to wells to fight other clans for access to water. And in drought-stricken areas of Sindh, Pakistan, farmers blame rival India for their water woes.
India violated the Indus Water Treaty, and now the supply of water from the rivers flowing in Pakistan is going down.
As we see in this hour, when water is scarce, it can ignite political tensions from the very smallest local level to a cross-border international scale. And with climate change and a growing world population, the stresses on this resource are only increasing. But amidst all this strife, there is progress. International powers are joining with regional governments to try to strengthen weak states like Somalia.
To give it, I think, the best shot that they've had in a very long time.
But first, one of the most desperate water situations in the world this year is in South Sudan. An ugly civil war between the country's president and vice president and their respective ethnic groups has been exacerbated by the country's desert climate, to the point where millions are facing famine as early as this fall. Here, water scarcity has not been the cause of conflict, but has made peaceful resolution of the war ever more difficult. A humanitarian crisis looms large as limited resources such as food and water decrease. This is more the rule than the exception, says Mark Giordano. He's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, who studies conflict and water scarcity.
I think almost always when you have water problems, there are actually problems that are tied up with other issues. So if you find people getting along, in general, you'll find that they get along over water and vice versa. So what you often get is water as an exacerbating factor of on top of some other set of problems that already exist.
We'll hear more analysis from Mark later in the program. But on the situation in South Sudan, we followed up with Manyang David Mayar. Manyang works with BBC Media Action. It's a charity organization that's based in Juba, the capital of South Sudan. He fled there from the town of Bor back in December. I asked him how difficult it is for the hundreds of thousands of people now flocking to refugee camps in Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, and in Juba to get water.
I am one of the people who drank very, very dirty water of the flood in Jonglei State. There's nowhere you can find clean drinking water all over the country, of course. That is a wide truth. And it is very, very difficult for these refugees to get clean drinking water. In Nawerial, for example, where I lived also, people were drinking water directly from the Nile. That is why a lot of diseases were contracted by mostly children, and many, many numbers of children died because of drinking the dirty water directly from the Nile.
What are the challenges to getting clean drinking water in that area, whether it's a rural village or even a refugee camp?
We cannot forget that South Sudan is a new country, and water infrastructures were not put in place even before the crisis started. There was no source of clean drinking water for everybody in the country. Even in Juba City, most of the people are drinking directly from the river, even in the areas where there are no insecurity, there is completely no clean drinking water for everybody in the country.
So we're hearing that the chaos in South Sudan means that people aren't able to plant crops, and that could actually lead to a significant shortage of food, maybe even as early as the end of this year. Is that true?
Exactly. The crisis that started has actually interrupted the agriculture in the country. There are no many people now farming their lands. There are no many people in the villages who are cultivating their land to deliver food to the market or even for their own consumption. So what was predicted by the president when he spoke to BBC was that there will be famine in the country this year because a lot of people who are actually food providers or food generators or food producers are not doing anything in the country. They were displaced, and instead of making their own food, they are now depending on humanitarian aid to get food. And in other areas, humanitarian aid reaching to where they are is really very, very difficult. So there is, of course, going to be famine in the country if things remain the way they are now. It is predicted, and it will happen. And it is happening now that there is food shortage in the country.
You haven't just been reporting this story. You've been living it. You had to flee your own village. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was on the date 18 of December. I was forced to leave my house. I was living in Bor town. So I was forced to leave to the bush, and I stayed in a makeshift camp for about 2 weeks. We were going out to ease ourselves in the water, in the flood waters, and we were drinking from the same waters. I was forced to sleep there under open skies, without ceiling, without roofs, and in the cold of December in South Sudan, and it was really very painful.
When you're living in the bush, when you're fleeing for your life, what do you eat? What do you drink?
I know what it means to go to the bush. So I carried along some beans with me, and we were surviving on those beans for some days. Our beans got finished, so luckily enough, there were some fishermen around. We ran to the bush near the River Nile. So the fishermen were bringing out some fish from the river. So we were buying those fish for survival. So both beans and fish made me what I am today.
That was Manyang David Mayar on the impending famine in South Sudan. Nancy Lindborg is the Assistant Administrator of the USA Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance within the U.S. Agency for International Development. She agrees that water scarcity is partly a feature of the desert climate in South Sudan, but it has been made worse by the political situation there.
It's a feature of poor governance. And in the case of Sudan, you have political leadership that is choosing political gain over the welfare of their people.
As for solutions, she says the U.S. is trying to work with all parties.
There is a very active peace process underway that is being led by the Intergovernmental Association for Development, IGAD. It's a regional body in the Horn of Africa that is leading the peace process. We have a special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan who has been very active in supporting that process. He's spent quite a bit of time in Addis. We have had top leadership in this government very, very engaged in pushing both sides towards the kind of peace that the people of South Sudan really deserve. In the meantime, because of what is a very logistically difficult environment and a country that's fragile in the best of times, markets have been disrupted. People are not able to get food for their families, and we are looking very seriously at the specter of famine coming as early as this fall. And then you have the rains that have already started. And once the rains start, most of the roads in South Sudan become what they call black cotton mud that literally traps your vehicles. So what we have now is very limited access along the river, and we need the combatants to enable the humanitarian actors to move on the river. And then we have to use airlifts, which are 11 times more expensive in terms of moving food around. So despite an extraordinary mobilization of humanitarian effort, we just simply are not able to get into the three conflict-affected states with the urgent humanitarian assistance that will be required.
Nancy Lindborg with USAID. On the border with South Sudan is a Turkana village called Loblono in northern Kenya. These Turkana people have survived for centuries in one of the harshest landscapes on earth, the dry-as-a-bone desert that also stretches across South Sudan and Somalia. The land is too dry for agriculture and the rains too unpredictable. So like the Sudanese and neighboring Somalis, they live a nomadic lifestyle based on herding cattle. They move entire communities across the desert, chasing the rain and the grasslands that sprout from the desert when it's wet. The Turkana have always been in conflict with neighboring tribes like the Pokot and the Tapasas. But in recent years, dwindling water supplies have exacerbated the conflict on the smallest of scales. Reporter Michael May visited and brought back this report.
The Turkana are a nomadic tribe, and their only possessions are their livestock, really. The village of Loblino is little more than a few temporary stick huts scattered across the sand. It looks like a strong wind could blow everything away. The only solid structure is a borehole and a gleaming solar water pump installed by the NGO Oxfam. It's why people have settled here. Hundreds of animals crowd around a trough, jostling to drink. There's not enough water, and you can hear their desperation.
Yeah, this is a battlefield.
James Orang is the chief of Loblano. It's a government-appointed position. He's dressed head to toe in khaki green like a soldier. The Turkana have been fighting for years with neighboring tribes, and the civil war in South Sudan has made the situation much worse.
They are now fighting in South Sudan. The government or the rebels, they get the guns. Then they spread it to the tribes like Topoza and Donguro. Those guys, they are coming. They are coming to fight us, to take animals by force.
Along the road, teenage boys herd goats with AK-47s slung over their shoulders. When the dry season comes, the Turkana move to the last remaining grazing areas along the border. But that's disputed land, and rival tribes will kill to protect their precious fields of grass. According to Chief Orang, they say,
"You are coming here to take our grass, our water."
Livestock rules everything around here. A Turkana man is judged on the size of his herd. To get married, he must have hundreds of camels, goats, and cattle as dowry. This pastoralist lifestyle has allowed the Turkana to adapt to the desert. But climate change is making it increasingly difficult to survive here. In 2006, a terrible drought and famine starved many and killed thousands of cattle. The reality is, they can't seem to rely on consistent rainy seasons here anymore.
How were the rains this year?
A shallow rain. And we're expecting this year a disaster. Disaster of drought.
And then tribes do what they've done for hundreds of years. Organize raids to replenish their stock.
Every tribe is going to search where to get the animal or the food for marriage. Yeah.
If there's rain and more food, there's less raids.
Yes. Because he's well fed.
He's happy and well fed.
Yeah. So when you get hungry, that's why they go and raid.
There is hope that this conflict could end. Recently, two discoveries were made that could completely transform life here: a substantial reserve of oil and a massive underground aquifer, the largest in Kenya. The oil could obviously bring much-needed jobs and roads to the region, and the water can be used to irrigate fields and ease the devastating cycle of drought and conflict. Benson Longor works for Oxfam in Turkana.
It is huge, but expectations of the people need also to be managed. They need to actually pump resources into making that water accessible. It is a priority for Turkana County government.
The effort could take years. It's not easy to build pipes to carry water across miles of desert, especially in an area that doesn't have paved roads. Another solution to the conflict is a peace settlement. Talk to anyone here in Loblano, and they'll point to a model. To the south of them, the Turkana have made peace with the Karamoja tribe, and it's lasted. Back in Loblano, Chief Orang says people here are tired of risking their lives just to feed their animals. He met with leaders of rival tribes 2 weeks ago to negotiate a ceasefire.
And we told each tribe, please, let us to preach peace. And instead our people to live together, maybe the problem will be reduced.
But 3 days ago, a schoolboy who had been herding goats limped into the village with a bullet wound in his leg. If he hadn't had a gun to defend himself, he likely would have been killed. Chief Orang told people here not to retaliate. Instead, he went back to the leaders and got a promise from them that they'd investigate and punish the perpetrators. Of course, there's a more radical way to bring about peace. Get rid of the animals who need this water, and you get rid of the fighting.
It's only because of the animals that we are fighting.
Celeste Noromo, speaking through a translator, is not afraid to let go of this traditional pastoralist lifestyle. She's an 18-year-old mother who's dressed like her ancestors, layer upon layer of colored beaded necklaces that over time have elongated her neck, a tightly braided mohawk, lines of ritual scarring on her forehead.
This life is very hard.
She's clearly proud of her heritage, but could move on. She's educating her son and hopes he'll get a job in the city and take her with him. The sun begins to set on Loblano. My guides and translators urge me to leave before night falls. We get back in the truck with our armed security detail following behind and head out across the desert. For America Abroad, I'm Michael May.
You're listening to Global Water Scarcity and Conflict on America Abroad. Coming up, water as a tool of terror in Somalia.
Al-Shabaab has deprived us of all access to water. It's not only in this city that they have done this.
Let us know your thoughts about this program. What should the U.S. do, if anything, to help countries like Somalia and South Sudan? Tweet us at America_abroad. I'm Hari Srinivasan, and you're listening to Global Water Scarcity and Conflict on America Abroad. Americans probably know Somalia best from the recent Tom Hanks film, Captain Phillips, in which Somali pirates hijack an unarmed container ship off the Horn of Africa.
Hey! Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me.
Sure.
I'm the captain now.
As the film demonstrates, lawlessness is a way of life in Somalia. And when you add civil war to the mix, life is unspeakably hard. The lack of a stable central government in Somalia has left the country vulnerable to conflict between clan rivalries and infiltration by terrorists for two decades. The African Union has tried over the years to repel terrorist groups such as Al-Shabaab with its African Union Mission, or AMISOM, troops, but their efforts have fallen short. AMISOM has lost 3,000 men. And while the civil war grinds on, unfortunately for the people of Somalia, water has become a central component of this war. Somali reporter Mahad Omar Dirye lives in Kenya but visited his homeland to file this report.
In some parts of Africa, when different clans come to the same watering holes, fights break out. But water has also become a critical part of the war-fighting strategy by the terrorist group known as Al-Shabaab in its battle against the Somali federal government. Children seen here at a nearby marriage ceremony in the city of Garbahare. It's one of the most strategic towns in southern Somalia. In April 2011, the Somali federal government troops, backed by the Ethiopian troops, took control of the city. But the terrorist group Al-Shabaab has successfully destroyed the supply of water to this city. Local resident Abdi Kadir explains.
Al-Shabaab attacked the city at night, and they buried the main borehole that supplied the city with water.
These boreholes were the primary source of water for the city.
In the morning, when we woke up, we found the borehole buried, leaving us without enough water for our children, ourselves, and our animals. We saved the little water we have for our children.
The River Juba is the other closest water source, but the locals can't access it because Al-Shabaab controls the city boundary. The only place to access the river, and Al-Shabaab doesn't allow people from the government-controlled areas to come to fetch water. Member of Parliament Abdel Latif Moussa Nour explains what the government's strategy has been against Al-Shabaab.
The first priority of the government and its allies was to capture the main towns, especially the ones with seaports, so that we can cut off any weaponry supplied to the Al-Shabaab.
For a while, this worked pretty well. Al-Shabaab has withdrawn from most of the big cities in Somalia. But now, he says,
Al-Shabaab has now changed tactics and started to cut off liberated cities from their water source so that they can demonstrate some kind of power and presence.
They have, he says, concentrated their forces on the regions that have the biggest and the best sources of water, as well as two seaports, and it is working. Parliamentarian Abdelatif Moussa Noor says the problem has been that the Amisom troops are limited, and there are no trained Somali troops to help to dislodge Al-Shabaab.
So we are now starting to train Somali military through Amisom, so that they can be left to safeguard the liberated town, which allow Amisom troops to go forward and drive these terrorists out of their cities. This plan is almost complete, and in the near future, it's going to be implemented.
Meanwhile, though, the city of Hodr in southwest Somalia is also in dire straits. The locals are very upset, because even though the city was liberated by Amisom and Somali troops in March 2014, Al-Shabaab has successfully used more water terrorism in the surrounding areas. Warfar lives in Hodr. He has been through a lot of hard times, but he never thought he would live to see water used in such a way.
Since the government forces allied by Amisom took control of the city, Al-Shabaab has deprived us of all access to water. The government and the Amisom troops have tried to push them out, but they did not manage to do so. Because the operation is too slow and because they are facing a fierce resistance from Al-Shabaab, Al-Shabaab does not want to lose control of the water points, because then that would mean their full defeat.
In response to Al-Shabaab's latest actions in Hodr, government troops and city officials have appealed to international donors for airdrops of food and water, which are now the only source of water. Warfar continues.
It's not only in this city that they have done this. When they were ousted from the capital city, Mogadishu, they did a tactical withdrawal and moved to regions in Somalia where there are rivers or other water sources, so that they can show they are in control and still exist.
Continued conflict, lack of food, climate change, and now water scarcity has taken an enormous social toll. Women have lost their husbands during the clan-based war, and now these same women grieve over the loss of their beloved sons, who are often forcibly recruited into Al-Shabaab. 45 years old, handicapped and a single mother, Halima lives in Wad Dereru, a town in central Somalia. Early this year, Somali government and Amisom troops liberated the town from Al-Shabaab. But Al-Shabaab withdrew to the rural areas and was able to cut off water to Halima's village. Because the rains did not come this year, Halima was forced to send her oldest boy to fetch water from the closest well, which was under the control of Al-Shabaab.
I sent my son to fetch water for me. He's only 16. I kept on waiting for him, but he did not come back. 20 days later, I learned that he was recruited by Al-Shabaab. Here we're desperate. They have occupied all the routes to the city, and we cannot get water, nor can we get food. And whenever we send our children to get us water or something, this is the obvious news. They don't come back.
For women like Halima, who have no husband or able-bodied sons, her choices are limited. Many of them become members of the IDPs or internal displaced persons. But government officials are promising that the hardship will not last forever. They say that their aim is for Amisom and Somali government forces to have pushed all Al-Shabaab out of the major cities and rural areas by the end of 2015. The hope is that by the beginning of 2016, government administrators will have established control of the rural areas so that Somalia can finally have an election based on one man, one vote. For America Abroad, this is Mahad Omar Dirie.
Nancy Lindborg is the Assistant Administrator of the USA Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance within the U.S. Agency for International Development. After many decades of humanitarian aid from the United States and other countries in Africa, She believes that the new internationally recognized federal government in Somalia has been making some effort toward state building and peace.
Somalia has really seized this opportunity with their interim government, and a number of key donors have consolidated behind that framework to give it, I think, the best shot that they've had in a very long time. I mean, it requires that they be very inclusive with civil society and with the regions. It will be a very long and bumpy road because they do still have, unfortunately, conflict going on at a time when there's also concern about the rainfall this year. I mean, that's a country that is battered by successive shocks of natural disaster in a context of continued conflict. What has been amazing has been the incredible resilience of the Somali people.
What has also helped the water situation in Somalia and all over the world, says Nancy Lindborg, are investments by USAID in something called FuseNet, or Famine Early Warning System Technology.
It helps us get better predictive data on critical issues related to food availability, crop patterns, rainfall, market prices. And over the last several years, we've added additional capabilities that help us better monitor water availability.
Rapid change in climate can create a lot of tension for populations. It can, says Lindborg, make conflict more likely when water is scarce. So knowing when there will be an El Nino or a drought ahead of time helps communities and countries manage water supplies. And that's important in places like the Horn of Africa, where in the past, droughts used to happen every 10 years. Now they're starting to happen every couple of years, she says. And aside from that, there's one other untapped resource her agency and the international community want to develop to help with water scarcity.
We are also paying quite a lot of attention to the role of women and water. Women are absolutely central in many communities in how water is accessed, how water is preserved, or water points are maintained. And it really goes to the heart of ensuring that when development programs are designed, that there be a very strong voice of the women in helping to think through what the impacts will be and how to ensure that they have safe access.
And that's a great introduction to our next report. In the slums of Nairobi, Kenya, is a project to get clean water to the poor, run by a cooperative of women. These women address a more subtle type of conflict, that between the haves and the have-nots, a sort of urban water war. Michael May has this report.
Every spare nook in Karen Gikonge's home in Kibera is filled with bright yellow jerry cans and large black drums of water. She hauls all this water home in a wheelbarrow, making sure to stock extra. There's often water shortages here.
What I have can take me for 2 weeks, because I have another super drum here.
The city of Nairobi does not provide running water to people squatting in the slums, so they rely on what's known as the water cartel. The cartel sells water at around 6 cents for a 20-liter jerry can, much more than wealthy Nairobians pay who have running water. These poor slum dwellers often spend around 20% of their budget on water.
It was very expensive buying from there.
Karen would eventually develop a model that would get around having to buy water. But before then, she used to buy water from a water merchant like Paul. He didn't want his last name used. He says, as far as Kibera occupations go, it's not bad.
It's an income-earning business.
It's basically pure profit. The business is based on stealing water by tapping into city lines.
Do you worry that the police would come and find you and arrest you for stealing water?
He doesn't worry. The police rarely bother with serious crime in Kibera, much less the illegal water business that people rely on to survive. But there is intense competition for business. The water merchants are constantly sabotaging each other. Paul tells me his lines are cut almost every week by competitors. You can see the results of these water wars. The lines running along the sewers have been repeatedly patched together. And walk along Kibera's lively avenues, and the first thing that hits you is the smell. Because there's no sewage system here either, Kibera residents often resort to defecating in plastic bags and throwing them in the street. They call them flying toilets. For Karen and other Kibera mothers, The lack of a water infrastructure has been a hazard.
For drinking, we must boil it because we know it's contaminated with all this dirt, the flying toilets, you know. So if you give your children like that, they start diarrhea.
So Karen and other women began to look for an alternative, and they weren't alone.
So many people did not see why should they work in the slums.
Vicky Mayo works for the Nairobi Water Utility. Until recently, the utility did virtually nothing to provide water for the poor. For one thing, the slum is illegal, and the government doesn't want to encourage more squatters. But a new constitution passed in 2010 makes water access a universal right.
So, of course, the company had to go back to the drawing board and see how best can we serve these people. We can no longer wish them away.
But in some ways, the utility's hands are tied. You'd have to evict half of Kibera to build the necessary infrastructure. So for now, the utility must partner with Kibera residents. 4 years ago, the utility connected with Karen Gekonge and a group of a dozen independent business owners known as the Wise Women. The Wise Women is a microfinance cooperative, and they got together to figure out how to build water and bathroom facilities in Kibera.
So we decided if we get this, it will help us financially, and we are going to help the community to have an hygienic place where they can do their cleanness, their hygienic ways.
The Wise Women got funding for the construction through an NGO called the Kenya Water for Health Organization. The Nairobi Water Utility provided the pipes and the water meter. The Wise Women now get free water for their families, and they also earn money from the fees that others pay to use the facility. Karen proudly shows me the small cement complex where they provide clean water and pit toilets. It has a whirring pump that brings water to a catchment tank on the roof.
They come, they shower, they use the toilets. They even take their water home from us. We know it's clean water. Where it comes from, it's never contaminated water.
That's because no one can vandalize their pipes. The Nairobi Water Utility installed a metal pipe deep underground. And Karen is doing well for herself. She's moved to the nicest neighborhood in Kibera. Back at her cozy cement home, she shows me what is by Kibera standards the ultimate luxury item, although she still has to fill the porcelain tank by hand.
And then I press the thing.
For America Abroad, this is Michael May.
The introduction of better water management and water technology can change lives in places like sub-Saharan Africa. And it's not just sub-Saharan Africa where water is a problem. The United Nations estimates that 750 million people lack access to clean water, and that almost 2.5 billion lack access to adequate sanitation. So we thought we'd look around the world to find some other technologies that might make a difference. In Indonesia, just like Kibera, Kenya, the urban poor don't have access to pipe water supply. They, too, have to buy their water from vendors.
And we calculate for a family of four in Indonesia, they could be spending 10% of their household income over the course of a year on purchasing water from private water vendors.
Mina Palaniappan is the founder and CEO of a nonprofit organization called Atma Mobile Networks. She believes that in a country in which nearly 85% of the people now have access to a smartphone, her technology can help the poor find clean water.
By opening up our mobile app, AtmaGo, what people in Indonesia are doing right now is they're able to get access to a list of water vendors in their area with phone numbers and prices so they can make better purchasing decisions on water and drive more efficiency and transparency in the urban water market. That's one way that we're unlocking the power of the mobile phones that people already have in their hands and rely on.
In South Africa, Grant Gibbs is the director of a nonprofit that's developed something called the Hippo Roller.
We've actually referred to it as the Hippo Roller because of the association of a hippopotamus, which has a round body with a very thick skin and lives in water.
It's essentially a big, hard plastic drum that takes only 1 hour to make and is aimed at trying to ease the burden of rural people who have to carry water on their heads or shoulders. Here's Grant.
It carries 24 gallons of water, and it is designed to roll over sharp rocks and glass and barbed wire, things that you typically find in rural communities.
The drum has a large screw cap and a steel handle that comes on and off depending on whether you're rolling it or standing it upright. Grant says they last 10 years, and
we've distributed about 45,000 rollers so far, and we're working on about 7 people per roller benefiting. You know, we've got over in excess of 300,000 beneficiaries so far. So it certainly is starting to make a big impact.
In many areas where water is hard to find, it's often also unsafe to drink. For instance, in India, the World Bank estimates that 21% of the communicable diseases are related to unsafe water.
I'm Ravi Reddy. I'm a very active philanthropist, founded the Community Pure Water Initiative in India.
Ravi runs a for-profit company working village to village to set up low-cost water sanitation facilities in rural areas.
We have a team with a general manager and a whole bunch of operators where we set up an RO/UV plant where we process the water and convert it into a safe drinking water. And it's centrally located in each village. And people come and pick up either 10 liters, 20 liters on an average per day.
Though the water is not free, Ravi claims it's priced in such a way that it's affordable, about half a penny per liter. And the key to success, he says, are that these plants are simple to operate, so he can get community buy-in in running them and maintaining them. Still,
it's a drop in the bucket, you know. When we talk about right now, we are only 150 plants. India alone has about 600,000 rural communities.
That was Ravi Reddy of Community Pure Water, Meena Palaniappan of Atma Mobile Networks, and Grant Gibbs from the Hippo Roller Project. You're listening to Global Water Scarcity and Conflict on America Abroad. Coming up, tensions between India and Pakistan over something other than nuclear weapons.
It's a matter of life and death for Pakistan. If our water is taken away from us, our agriculture will be affected severely.
To learn more and to see photos from our reporters' travels, visit our website, americaabroad.org. I'm Hari Srinivasan, and you're listening to Global Water and Conflict on America Abroad. Pakistan is one of the most water-insecure countries in Asia, according to the 2013 Asian Development Bank report. And one of the hardest-hit areas in Pakistan is the Sindh province. It's mostly desert. It's in the northernmost region and shares a border with India. Here, migration in search of water is a way of life. And those who live here say that India is making their life harder. Malik Ayub Sumbul went to Sindh and filed this report. It's being narrated by Kasim Hasnain.
For Pannu and his family, the desert is in the promised land. It is a desperate place to live. At only 25 years of age, Pannu already has a thin web of wrinkles on his face and pain in his eyes.
We are facing the worst water shortage. We are poor people, and the high-ups are paying no heed towards this water shortage. We are helpless and badly suffering.
Though he owns many acres of land, he and his family live a semi-nomadic life. Without enough water, the land is impossible to cultivate. And even though his wife, children, and other family members lower their buckets as far as 150 feet below ground level, the nearest well is running dry. Women, like Pannu's wife, are often the ones walking barefoot in the blazing sun over many miles to fetch the water. And even after they find it, the quality can be very bad.
The water of the wells in my area has become undrinkable. The water level is getting lower day by day, and by drinking this muddy, hard water, our children are suffering from diarrhea and other stomach diseases. We are losing our animals, and to us, losing our animals is like losing our family members.
So Pannu and his family must move on to find more water.
We are searching for water everywhere, but it is really hard to find water. Our animals are dying, and we have no water, even for drinking.
Hey. The onset of the monsoon season does little to help. The torrential rains will flood the rivers, which will destroy their lands and mud houses, and will leave hunger and disease. Villagers like Pannu believe that this uneven supply of water is only made worse by Pakistan's water struggles with India.
India violated the Indus Water Treaty, and now the supply of water from the rivers flowing in Pakistan is going down, and in the near future, they will be almost inactive.
But so far, Pannu's predictions have not come to pass, and the water issues often get mixed up in the larger political tensions between the two countries. According to this treaty, Pakistan has control of the water of western rivers, Jhelum, Chenab, and Indus, and India has control of the eastern rivers, Ravi, Bias, and Satluj. Pakistan claims India has violated the treaty by constructing the Kishanganga Dam on the Jhelum River, the river under Pakistan's control. Pakistan's former Foreign Office spokesperson, Abdul Basit, argues.
It's a matter of life and death for Pakistan. If our water is taken away from us, our agriculture will be affected severely. And this happened actually last summer. We are also trying to build run-of-river dams on the rivers which belong to us. But if we do not have water, obviously our long-term planning to overcome our energy deficit, that will also be hampered.
Pakistan also argues that India has recently violated the treaty by starting construction on a new project on Kirtani Hydropower in Jammu and Kashmir on the Chenab River. But in response to these charges, India says that it is abiding by accepted run-of-the-river uses of the water. Water flows through these dams for hydropower, but continues to flow through to Pakistan. Razaul Hassan is an Indian political analyst.
There is a shortage of water even in India, because there are lots of large cities which need water. Water is needed mainly for agriculture. The Indian leaders have been insisting that, they are building projects in Jammu and Kashmir, but these are projects which are totally within the provisions of the Indus Waters Treaty.
And so far, it seems that even through two outright wars, the treaty dispute settlement system has worked, says David Mickle. He is the director of the Environmental Security Center at the nonpartisan Stimson Center in Washington.
Both India and Pakistan saw some of their concerns addressed by both decisions. Neither side received total satisfaction, but the projects in both cases were allowed to go forward.
And another wrinkle in Pakistan's position is that domestically, Pakistan does not manage its water well. A lot of water goes to waste. And according to David Mickle, Pakistan's Punjab province is arguably diverting more water than what is fair from Sindh, even though they claim to be within the letter of the domestic water sharing agreement.
The difficulty is that Punjab, the most populous and politically most powerful province of Pakistan, it lies upstream from Sindh. It can take out its defined quantity of water under the agreement before the water reaches Sindh.
Even so, Pakistan has one major legitimate concern, say treaty watchers like David Mickle. When you add up all the potential water infrastructure projects India has gotten permission to build over the years, the total effect could make Pakistan very vulnerable.
It's that fear that India can manipulate the flow of the river over time that could potentially strangle Pakistan's agriculture. Pakistan is worried that should it choose to do so, India could effectively throttle Pakistan's food security and its domestic economy.
Back in Sindh, though Pannu and his family struggle on with little water, they have not lost hope. In the evening when they get together for dinner, they optimistically talk about the bright future.
I am sure that one day all of these problems will be solved. Our lands will be irrigated, and that will open a new horizon of progress and prosperity for us.
That story from Malik Ayub Sumbul, narrated by Kasim Hasnain. Mark Giordano is a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, who specializes in transboundary water conflicts. He points to the India-Pakistan dispute over water as one of the areas in the world that conflict could emerge over water. But overall, he too believes the treaty has worked pretty well. And in general, he argues water is not usually a cause for conflict.
Globally, there are something like 280 rivers that are shared between two or more countries. And most of those you've never heard of before because there's no problem. And in fact, there's often a treaty between the countries that governs how things work. So they're actually one of the examples of the highest form of cooperation between two countries, that they sign treaties to deal with their issues between them. There are a number of reasons why international water conflicts are less likely than many people think that they are. One is that, you know, water is a very heavy and, in general, low-value product. You know, what are you going to do when you invade another country? You're going to take the water, you're going to pipe it away, or what are you going to do? You have to control the territory. Another factor is that you're not going to war just over water, you're going to war with the country in general. So that means you're risking all the other relationships you have with the country.
When we talk about internal conflicts, say in Somalia or South Sudan, it seems that water is more of a byproduct than the cause of the fight. Do you think that's accurate?
I do think that is accurate. I think almost always when you have water problems, there are actually problems that are tied up with other issues. So if you find people getting along, in general, you'll find that they get along over water and vice versa. So what you often get is water as an exacerbating factor on top of some other set of problems that already exist.
We're also seeing indications that access to water is being used as a tool for terrorism. Al-Shabaab has gone and buried boreholes and polluted certain sources of water. I mean, is that cause for alarm?
I think that is cause for alarm. And I would view that somewhat differently than when people normally talk about water as a source of conflict. One way of talking about water as conflict is people conflicting over the water, of sharing the water itself. The other is using water as a weapon, which is the example you just used, where you destroy someone's water, you poison their well, you blow up their dam as a tool of war. And I think that's a critical issue. In the U.S., there's now lots of money going into protecting water supplies because of fear of terrorism.
One of the things we're also hearing from people on the ground in several different places is that the stresses on water by climate change are getting worse.
That appears to be true. There's a lot of uncertainty and there's a lot of variation from place to place, but the general consensus seems to be that the stresses on water are growing. And it's not just that there might be less water, it's that the variability is increasing, which means it's much harder to manage. It's much harder to have it when you need it. There might actually be more water, but it all comes at the same time and can cause flooding instead of being able to be used productively.
Combine that with a population that continues to go up. Do you see these sorts of factors contributing to water becoming the source of conflict in the future?
I think you have to look at it in a long-term and a short-term perspective. There are a lot of things that can be done to manage water better. At the moment, most people value it at close to zero, and as a result, there's a lot of waste. So there's a lot of room for improvement. So even in the U.S., where regulation is fairly tight, water tends to be highly undervalued. Some sectors get it at very low prices, others pay more. But we're not consistent, and in general, it's undervalued.
So the technology solutions that can help the infrastructure or the delivery or the transparency of information around water, it seems that people can come up with those solutions. So what's stopping those solutions from actually getting to market?
Well, one of the issues is the pricing that we just talked about. Often there's no incentive to put them in place, so we use regulatory frameworks instead of pricing. And I'm not saying that pricing is necessarily the right answer. Often it's political will and political decision-making. The U.S. has underinvested in infrastructure for a long time, and so you'll see pipes breaking in cities now. Irrigation systems tend to be in poor conditions, the same in other parts of the world. And the problem in many developing countries, when people talk about a global water crisis and the 2 billion people without access to fresh water, that tends not to be an issue of water scarcity. It's an issue of having the political will to pay for the infrastructure to put the pipes in.
So really, water comes down to becoming a political issue then?
Water comes down to being a political issue. But change is happening all around the world. If you look in the U.S., for example, our per capita water use started dropping about 1980 and is now down to about 1950 levels. And that's because we put in new regulations. We've changed pricing policies. We've changed the way water is managed as it's become more scarce. Australia has made similar changes to its water policy. But these things are difficult. Anytime you make change, there are people for and against. Australia took 30 or 40 years to set up their system, and they put a lot of money into making sure that it politically worked. So there are examples around, but they tend to be context-specific. You have to figure out the problems in that particular place and then put in solutions that fit that place and that time and those people.
That was Professor Mark Giordano at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. This hour was written and edited by Martha Little and produced by Rob Sachs, with additional production help from Flawn Williams. Our intern is Michael Abrams. You can hear past programs by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, finding us on the TuneIn or Public Radio International apps, or by visiting our website, americaabroad.org. I'm Hari Srinivasan, and this is America Abroad from Public Radio International. Support for this show was provided by Public Radio International stations and listeners like you. Support was also provided by the Stewart Family Foundation and Turkish Airlines.
PRI, Public Radio International.